Well, good morning. Today and concluding next Lord's Day, we're going to be discussing the problem of evil and suffering. Last couple of weeks, we looked at the defense for is Jesus the only way? And we also looked at a particular challenge that one tends to find themselves in a discussion with at times, and that is, what about the one who's never heard? The word hasn't been brought forth to them, and so forth. And those tend to be very intellectual type problems. In the problem of evil and suffering, we'll find that, as we'll discuss, that there is actually an intellectual and an emotional, but I will tell you right up front, and you already know this, the real issue that many find with this problem tends to be much more emotional than intellectual. Now, the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" Genesis 3:1. "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Genesis 3:5. As ambassadors of Christ, as Christians, perhaps the biggest challenge you may face is making sense of the problem of evil. In your ability to articulate a sound argument in response to the one who would ask, "What about the evil and the suffering that is amongst us in this world?" The presence of evil in the world is considered by some to be the strongest evidence against God. This argument is persistently raised against theism. How do you respond to the one who would make this challenge? How do you respond to the one who is searching for an answer when it seems to them that their world is collapsing around them? Being able to provide an answer, being equipped to give a reasonable explanation to those who would ask, not only enhances your skills as an ambassador of Christ, but it also provides you with another step in cultivating a more sensible faith. As a Christian, I am persuaded that the problem of evil, terrible as it is, does not in the end constitute a disproof of the existence of God. On the contrary, in fact, I think that Christian theism is man's last best hope of solving the problem of evil. Well, beginning today and concluding next Sunday, my intent is to address the intellectual and philosophical arguments along with the emotional roadblocks posed by the problem of evil and suffering in a manner that I have found quite satisfying. Additionally, this approach not only attacks the intellectually vacant arguments put forth by atheists, but it also addresses the humanitarian concerns, that is, the emotional, that quite frankly, I would tell you, plays a much larger role in an individual's disbelief in the existence of God than the intellectual or philosophical arguments that have been put forth. The intellectual problem of evil concerns how to give a rational explanation of how God and evil can coexist. The emotional problem of evil concerns how to dissolve people's emotional dislike of a God who would permit suffering. To illustrate these two points, I'm going to share with you two slides as an example of the intellectual or philosophical arguments for evil. And then I will share two slides that are examples of the emotional problem of evil. And I think after we go through these four slides, you'll probably come to the same realization, which you probably have already without seeing them, that quite frankly, it's the emotional argument that tends to be the biggest obstacle for many. Well, Epicurus was an ancient Greek philosopher. He lived sometime during the time of about 341 to 270 BC. He was the founder of the school of philosophy called Epicureanism. And his argument, his philosophical argument, is one of the earliest arguments found arguing against the existence of God based on evil and suffering. He wrote, "Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God?" That's one example of the intellectual argument. Another, and this is the more modern philosophical arguments that you'll see out there put forth, are sort of three versions. The atheist, the atheistic philosopher will say that an all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving, all good God exists, but evil exists. Or they'll take statement one again, and they'll say extreme and horrendous evil exists. Or the third version is they'll take statement number one, all-powerful, all-good, all-loving, all-knowing God exists, and they'll argue that gratuitous and pointless evil exists. The atheists have claimed that these statements, one, and then either 2A, 2B, 2C, are logically contradictory, or at least extremely unlikely to be true. This is the problem of evil as they would state it. Yet in the secular world of philosophy today, it is widely acknowledged that all three forms of the problem of evil have failed. Yet you will still hear these arguments put forth. One last point. Theists, Christians, we do not accept the premise which is 2C, that is, an all-powerful, all-God, all-loving, all-knowing God exists, gratuitous and pointless evil exists. We argue, quite frankly, that there is no gratuitous and pointless evil. Yet on a deep and visceral level, evil often feels pointless and thus gratuitous. Hence, the emotional problem of evil tends to dominate for many in their objection of God. Well, the next two slides are going to be looking at the emotional argument. And I give this by example. Eli Wiesel, a writer, professor, Nobel laureate, and Holocaust survivor, wrote in his book, Night, which is based on his experience as a young Orthodox Jew of being sent with his family to the German concentration camps. The following is an account out of his book. The SS seemed more preoccupied, more disturbed than usual. To hang a young boy in front of thousands of spectators was no light matter. The head of the camp read the verdict. All eyes were on the child. He was lividly pale, almost calm, biting his lips. The gallows threw its shadow over him. This time, the camp executioner refused to act as executioner. Three SS replaced him. He goes on to write, the victims mounted together onto the chairs. The three necks were placed at the same moment within the nooses. Long live liberty, cried the two adults, but the child was silent. Where is God? Where is he? Someone behind me asked. At a sign from the head of the camp, the three chairs were tipped over. Total silence throughout the camp. On the horizon, the sun was setting. Bare your heads, yelled the head of the camp. His voice was raucous. We were weeping. Cover your heads, he yelled. Then the march past began. The two adults were no longer alive. But the third rope was still moving. Being so light, the child was still alive. For more than half an hour, he stayed there, struggling between life and death, dying in the slow agony under our eyes. And we had to look him full in the face. He was still alive when I passed in front of him. Behind me, I heard the same man asking, where is God now? And I hear a voice within me answer him, where is he? He is. He is hanging here on this gallows. How many of you have seen the movie Sophie's Choice? Anybody? Yeah. Well, in 1982, a film came out titled Sophie's Choice. It included an account of a Polish woman in a concentration camp whose decision there changed her life forever. Two-thirds of the way through the movie, Sophie, who is depicted or was depicted in the movie by Meryl Streep, recounts the tragic incident to a friend. She goes on to telling her friend, I was arrested. My children were sent with me to Auschwitz. When the train arrived at Auschwitz, the Germans made their selection, who would live and who would die. As she reflects, there's a flashback, and she sees a soldier in front of her. You may keep one of your children. The other one must go. Do you mean I have to choose? I can't choose. You are a Pole, not a Jew. That gives you a privilege, a choice. I can't choose. I can't. Choose or I'll send them both away. John, my little boy, was sent to the children's camp, Sophie said quietly. And my little girl, Eva, was sent to crematorium, too. She sighed and she wiped her eyes. She was exterminated. Then as tears spilled silently down on Sophie's face, she said, I knew that Christ had turned his face away from me and that only a Jesus who no longer cared for me could kill those people that I loved. This dramatic and moving account, along with the countless testimonies of real human suffering, would fill volumes and volumes of books. And I think it echoes sometimes the deepest fear we have in our hearts of God. We look upon the world and we wonder. We see the tragedy, we see the evil, and we see the innocent suffering. And we're aware of the difficult choices that we have to make, and we wonder about God. Well, maybe for an atheist or an agnostic, it's this particular problem that has kept them away from believing that God really exists. If God was really good and powerful, he would deal with this problem. Incidentally, this was Einstein's objection. He had come to the conclusion in studying physics and in his own discoveries that there must be a God, but it couldn't be the God of the Bible, because of the problem of suffering and evil that he saw. You may not be an atheist or an agnostic. Quite frankly, you may be a Christian. So you're not so much questioning the existence of God, but when you face the difficult things of life, the things that knock you down, the suffering that makes you feel you are being torn apart, the relentless evil you witness or experience in your own life, then you might question not God's power, but God's goodness. C.S. Lewis faced this dilemma when he lost his wife. He knew too much to disbelieve in God's existence. He said he didn't question the existence of God. He questioned his character. He thought, now I know the God I love and serve. This objection, the problem of evil and suffering, is perhaps the most tenacious objection against Christianity. Perhaps because it goes to the heart and the core of every person's life, because everybody has been victimized at one time or another by the evil in this world. Hence, the question about evil and suffering is, quite frankly, a very fair question, and a question that we as Christians should be prepared to try to give a reasonable answer to for those who would ask or for those who would question. It doesn't deserve, this question, a quick answer. It requires us to think. And unfortunately, many are not too prone to deep thinking about their faith, particularly when we are faced with detractors around us. The truth, though, is that most people who object to God give shallow objections, maybe significant ones, but nonetheless they are shallow because they have not been well thought out. So we are going to spend some time thinking through this objection because there are perhaps more issues involved here. There are more elements in the equation than just God's goodness or his power in dealing with the problem of evil and suffering. There may be some reasons as why God has allowed evil for a season, and that precisely because of his goodness, he has allowed this to happen. I have four main points in response to this challenge of the problem of evil and suffering. But before I go into the actual discussion about the problem of evil and suffering, we need to lay a foundation. The first two points that I will make this morning are the ground rules that we have to agree upon before we can even discuss the problem any further. It's like any significant issue where we have to define the terms and agree on some things before we can go forward. These first two points will probably take up the remaining time that we have today. Actually, they will take up the remaining time. And hopefully we'll get through them. But these points are so important because, quite frankly, you cannot have a discussion with anyone unless there's agreement on these first two points. We will conclude with the remaining 2 points, along with what God is doing about evil next week. So we're going to get through hopefully points 1 and 2 today, and then point 3, 4 next week. So what's the first point? The first point is evil is something. Now, underline the word something, and exists and real, but evil is something. We have to agree upon the fact that evil is something. In other words, that evil actually exists, that evil is real. And you're probably sitting there thinking, but of course evil is real. And if you believe that, then quite frankly, I'm glad, because it's true. But the fact is, many people that you talk to about this issue don't really believe that evil exists. They may think that some things are bad and things that other people do towards others is not right or may be inappropriate or wrong. But if you really try to pin them down to what is actually wrong, what is ultimately wrong, what is absolutely evil, then people begin to back up because many have a belief that morals are relative. Right or wrong is a matter of circumstances, they will argue. What's right for you may be good for you, but it may not be right for me. My truth is my truth. Your truth is your truth. What's interesting is many people live lives in moral contradiction. They say there is no absolute wrong and right, but there is much middle ground. A middle ground where things may be right for you, but not for me. Where people may make up their own rules. Where people can have their own truth. Of course, that truth is with a lowercase t, not a capital T, because it doesn't apply to everyone. Nowadays, this philosophy is so entrenched in our culture that no one questions it anymore. Of course, there is no absolute wrong, and hence why people will say government should not legislate morality, without realizing that most every law the government passes is a legislation of morality. The law is saying what is wrong, and this is right. And if you do wrong, there are consequences to the action. And so we are living in a kind of moral grayness, a time of moral relativism. And this creates some interesting kinds of conflicts. On one hand, you will have an individual tell you there are no moral absolutes. So it's wrong for you to shove your view, quite frankly, down my throat. But they don't have any right to say that when you think about it. Because if you don't believe in moral absolutes, you can never say anything is wrong. All you can say is, it's just not the way I view it, but you may have a different opinion. Moral relativism is itself a contradiction. It is like saying, there are no moral absolutes, here's one. Think about it. It is nonsensical and it's absurd. Is premarital sex wrong? Well, it's right if it's right for you. What about abortion? That's an individual choice. What about killing? It depends. What about stealing? Not from a corporation. And as a result, most people are drowning in a sea of moral relativism. They don't know which way to turn. The irony is, it's that inside, they all have a sense. We all have a sense of wrong and right. It's what Francis Schaeffer calls moral motions. They do things and they act and they talk as if things were right and wrong. They object when someone takes something from them or steals from them or even treats them curtly. That's not right, they'll say. Oh, do you mean that's just your opinion that it's not right or really wrong? And if there are no absolutes, if everything is allowed, ultimately nothing is disallowed. If nothing is disallowed, then nothing is ultimately wrong. And if nothing is ultimately wrong, then nothing is ultimately evil. And if nothing is ultimately evil, then evil doesn't exist. You following me there? How do we know the difference between a good golfer and a bad golfer? Or a good tennis player and a bad tennis player? You pick your sport. We know it by their scores. So hence, there's a method of keeping scores, and by these scores, we are able to make a judgment about them. They're a good golfer, they're a poor golfer. I'm a poor golfer. In the same way, the word evil gets its meaning from the existence of a system of moral scoring, utilizing a perfect moral standard. Hence, evil is a value judgment that identifies a departure from a standard of moral perfection or perfect goodness. Thus, something is evil if it departs from this perfect standard. C.S. Lewis points out that a portrait is a good or bad likeness depending on how it compares with the perfect original. But if there is no standard, there is no departure. C.S. Lewis said, "My argument against God was that the universe seemed cruel and unjust. But how had I gotten this idea of just and unjust? Man does not call something crooked unless he has an idea of what a straight line is." The atheist's entire objection to God's existence, based on the existence of evil, hinges on the observation that true evil exists objectively. Thus, they must argue that evil must be out there as some objective feature of the world. Some things must and are truly, objectively wrong. And it is these things we call evil. But again, relativism holds that the word evil reflects just a mere personal preference. And this takes the guts out of the objection, hence why relativism cannot come into play in a discussion with somebody about this. And that's what point one is, that you're picking up, is about. Because it's just a matter of opinions and preference. Imagine how silly this conversation would sound to you between two people. Here we go. "I can't believe in God." "Why not?" "Brussels sprouts." "Brussels sprouts? What do Brussels sprouts have to do with anything?" "You ever taste those things? They're awful. And I can't believe in a God that would create something that tastes so awful to me." Silly, isn't it? Do you see, though, where I'm heading with this? Because relativism views moral statements merely as statements about personal tastes. Brussels sprouts. The problem of evil is reduced to, how could a good God allow things that, quite frankly, are contrary to my tastes and opinions? C.S. Lewis clarifies, "Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too, for the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies." Relativism and the problem caused by objective evil make for strange bedfellows, because they both can't be true at the same time. If morality is ultimately a matter of personal taste, like preferring a steak over Brussels sprouts, the objection vanishes because the objection depends on the fact that some things are intrinsically evil. And as I mentioned earlier, if there is no absolute wrong or right, then there is no evil. And thus, how can we hold God accountable for something that doesn't exist? How can we hold God accountable for something that ultimately doesn't exist if morals are simply a person's own opinions? Let me illustrate this point in this imaginary conversation between two people. Some things must be intrinsically wrong for there to be an objection, okay? Okay, I admit there are some things intrinsically wrong. What is it that is intrinsically wrong then? Well, maybe killing innocent people? How do you know that is intrinsically wrong? Well, it is. It's kind of self-evident. Well, other people don't believe that. Hitler killed many innocent people, and he didn't think it was intrinsically wrong. Well, it's just the way I feel about it. So, in other words, it's just your opinion. Well, yeah. So someone else can have another opinion. Well, yeah. So the problem we're faced with, if we admit that there is an intrinsic evil, is that we can't be the one to define what that intrinsic evil is, because we're back to opinions once more. As Francis Schaeffer points out, the relativist has both feet planted firmly in midair. However, if you can complain about evil because true evil does exist, then you can't be an atheist. real evil must mean there's a real God. Where else did this objective transcendent system of scorekeeping come from? If there is no God, then there's no perfect standard, no absolute right or wrong, and therefore no departure from that standard. If there is no God, then there is no evil. And we're back to personal likes and dislikes once again. We're back to where we started, relativism. In a 1991 movie called The Quarrel, two Jewish friends happen upon each other after several years. They meet in a park. Rabbi Hirsch, a survivor of Auschwitz, whose faith was strengthened by his ordeal, explains this notion to his friend Chaim, who himself escaped the Nazis and along the way lost his faith. Rabbi Hirsch goes on to say, quote, "If there's nothing in the universe that's higher than human beings, then what's morality? Well, it's a matter of opinion. I like milk, you like meat. Hitler likes to kill people, I like to save them. Who's to say which is better? Do you begin to see the horror of this? If there is no master of the universe, then who's to say that Hitler did anything wrong? If there is no God, then the people that murdered your wife and kids did nothing wrong." Unquote. Are you seeing the problem that the atheist finds themselves in? And are you starting to see the evidence for God's existence, that the existence of evil itself supports God's existence? Is it making sense? If we live in a world where there is no God, all of this doesn't matter. Humans are just another animal, bags of protoplasm. 35 million deaths are just 35 million bags of weak protoplasm being destroyed by stronger bags of protoplasm. In an atheistic world, you better be a strong bag, because neither good nor evil exists. It is survival of the fittest. Well, how do we know what's intrinsically evil? Here's another problem, and this is more of an applicational problem. We always want to define what is evil, what's really bad, and we want to define it in terms that makes us, quite frankly, look pretty good. In other words, every person basically thinks they're a good person. I mean, really, aren't you a good person? The people that are basically bad are somewhere else. They're sort of down there, you know, away from us, below us, somewhere else. You talk to a person who goes to church every week, or perhaps a synagogue, who's very religious. They help others. They do good works. I mean, they try their best. Well, that's a basically good person. And their life, quite frankly, is evidence of the good things that they try to do. The bad person is a person who doesn't come to church or synagogue, doesn't believe in God, doesn't involve himself in these things. So you talk to the next guy, and he says, "Well, I don't go to church or synagogue, but I believe in God, I worship God in my own way, I'm not bad, I'm basically good." Well, who's bad then, you ask? Well, he's a guy who never comes to church and doesn't believe in God either. And by the way, he does bad things. Okay, so you go and you talk to that guy. "Well, I don't go to church, and I don't believe in God, but I'm basically good because I don't hurt people." Well, too much. Well, maybe a little, but it's not my fault. The really bad people are the people who hurt others on purpose, quite frankly. So you go and talk to that person, and he says, "Yeah, I hurt some people. Everyone makes mistakes, but I never killed anybody." Okay, so you go and you talk to the "I killed somebody." And he says, "I'm basically a good person. I never murdered lots of people." Yeah. Okay, so you go and you talk to the "murdered lots of people." And he says, "Well, at least I'm not a Hitler." You see, we always want to define evil in a way that makes us look good. Our standards are too subjective, because our interests are involved. Well, think about this. Everyone thinks he's basically a good person. After all, I'm not guilty of rape, torture, or mass murder. I am not a Hitler. Yet this only proves you're not a criminal, not that you're a truly good person. You may not be a Hitler, but you're not a Jesus Christ either. And you're probably a lot more like Hitler than you are like Jesus. So if we admit that there must be some things that are intrinsically good or bad, someone else has to define that. In order for something to be absolutely wrong, we must have an absolute reference point, and that means there has to be an absolute being that defines what's good and what's bad. And if God, as an absolute being, is the one who defines good and bad, his definition includes a lot more than rape, torture, and mass murder. And so we run into an ironic situation here. Here we're talking about evil, possibly proving there is no God. If God exists, there would be no evil, yet evil exists, therefore there is no God. That is what the atheist, that is what the skeptic will put forth time after time after time. Yet what I am suggesting here to you is the fact that real, true, absolute evil does exist in the world. The only kind of evil we can complain about. And it is this evil that actually proves that God exists. And it's amazing when you start to think about it, when the pieces start to come together. If God doesn't exist, there is no evil. Just people's opinions, remember? This is why the existence of evil is one of the best evidence for the existence of God. Not against Him, but for Him. It supports the existence for a personal and moral God from whom our moral rules come from. And what are moral rules? A moral rule is both a proposition and a command, and these are features which require a mind. Ethicist Richard Taylor explains, "A duty is something that is owed, but something can be owed only to some person or persons. There can be no such thing as a duty in isolation. The concept of moral obligation is unintelligible apart from the idea of God. The words remain, but their meaning is gone." The atheists will argue that moral rules, quite frankly, have evolved. And I've heard their arguments. And they're not good arguments. But the way they can be put forth can be somewhat compelling. And that's how they try to escape and get around morality and moral rules, and that God is not necessary for the creation of the moral value system that we exist in. That these things are developed by cultures and through time. Well, perhaps Thomas Merton, who is a Trappist monk, perhaps you would like the way he put this whole thing. Quote, "In the name of whom or what do you ask me to behave? Why should I go to the inconvenience of denying myself the satisfactions I desire in the name of some standard that exists only in your imagination? Why should I worship the fictions that you have imposed on me in the name of nothing?" Unquote. Therefore, you cannot even begin to debate the issue of evil if there is no God. And why? Because there would be no true evil to discuss. There would just be stuff. There would only be differing opinions about what is pleasant or unpleasant, desired or not desired. Thus, the alternative is, if God doesn't define evil, then one person, one group, or society does whatever they think is best from their particular point of view. The atheist's argument on morality. Problem is, that's where you get Hitler's, Idi Amin's, Pol Pot's, Stalin's, and others like them. In those circumstances, whatever is right in their minds. And then the ethic that is practice becomes an ethic of practicality. It is not a moral ethic. Might makes right. Whoever is strongest rules and does what they want to do. And this, my friends, is pure and unadulterated social Darwinism. So evil must be something real. It must be something that exists, and it must be something that is defined by God. If there is no God, there's no evil to discuss. So before we can even talk about that, we have to agree that God is the one who defines that evil, what evil is, and He gives the absolute standard. Then we can ask, how does evil exist? So the conclusion for point one, which is what we've been talking about this whole time, is that evil is something. Relativism cannot come into the discussion. Relativism can be defeated. It is circular reasoning. The second point, and this is a much shorter point, we have to agree on something else. That evil is not something. Now, this isn't double speak on my part. I said in point one that evil is something. What I'm saying here is in point two, evil is something. And here's what I mean by it. Evil is not some black, gooey stuff that floats around the universe, some diabolical virus that attaches onto us and makes us do bad things. It's not some stuff out there. In other words, if you had a microscope, you couldn't place evil on a slide, put it under that microscope, and under the greatest magnification, see evil. You couldn't take the most powerful telescope, the Hubble, and look out into the far reaches of the universe and see evil floating out there. It is not something that has substance. It's not some kind of stuff. Instead, it is a description of an unnatural or improper relationship between two things. It is not something itself, but a way in which we describe the relations between things. Stay with me, because I think this illustration is going to help. You have a human body and a piece of metal. Neither is intrinsically evil, you would agree. Or I would hope you would agree. If you take that piece of metal, though, and you penetrate the human body, it may be evil depending on the relationship. If that piece of metal is a scalpel, which is wielded by a skilled surgeon removing a tumor, then the relationship between that metal and the body is a good thing. Would you not agree? However, if that metal is a knife being wielded by a killer and it is plunged into the belly, then that is something that's evil. Same metal, same body, different relationship. The event becomes evil when the created thing is used as an instrument for an evil purpose. Evil is a word that describes the condition of something missing. I want you to think donut holes. I'm not talking about the bag of donut holes you get at Dunkin' Donuts. I want you to imagine the actual donut hole. Donut holes and shadows are not things in themselves, but things missing. Are they not? Evil is a hole in goodness. It is a shadow that results when goodness is missing. Philosopher William Dembski notes, "Evil always parasitizes the good. Indeed, all our words for evil presupposes a good that has been perverted. Impurity presupposes purity. Unrighteousness presupposes righteousness. Deviation presupposes a way from which we departed. Sin presupposes a target that was missed," and so on. So evil isn't some thing. Yet why am I making this distinction? Because if evil, and stay with me on this one, because I think this just crystallizes it for us. If evil is not something with substance, then it didn't need to be created. If it didn't need to be created, then it didn't need a creator. And therefore, we don't have to point the finger at God and say, why did you create evil when evil was not something that was ever created? And this opens the door then for another explanation for evil, other than God made it. But first, two comments. I've heard it said that one can read the first three chapters and the last three chapters of the Bible to find the issue of evil described, explained, and resolved. So you may want to check that out. Read those first three chapters and flip over to Revelation and read the last three chapters. Secondly, one may still say, well, God, though, God allowed evil. But that's a separate issue. And that's an issue we're going to take up next week. So what are some of the alternate explanations for the existence of evil, since this is the main objection against God? Next week, we'll look at what God says about the existence of evil in the world and the reasons for it and why He's allowed it and what He's doing about it. Now, amazingly enough, I actually finished without the students actually being in the hallway. That's a lot of information, but these first two points are absolutely critical, that you understand them, and that if you get into discussion with someone, that there's agreement on those things, that evil is something and evil is a thing, right? It is taking the argument of the relativist out of the equation. Because think about it. If the argument with someone is just based on opinions, facts has no play. I mean, I've heard a relativist in a talk when she was asked about, you know, the murder of innocent children by some tribe. I can't recall the name of the tribe. And she continued to get pressed on, but is it wrong? Is it wrong? She would not admit it was wrong. She kept going back to, well, in that culture, well, in that time, well, who am I to judge? There are people that will hold that opinion. Perhaps not a whole lot, but people that will. You can't have this discussion with that kind of a mindset. Are there any questions or comments on this? Next week, then we will take up the next two points, and then also what God is doing about this. I think it'll all come together. It is perhaps, I think, one of the better talks as far as that I've heard over time, and some of the books that I've read about evil, where it sort of tries to deal with the intellectual argument. But as we'll deal with next week, it starts to get more involved into the emotional, where, quite frankly, as I showed you and illustrated earlier, right, I think it is the emotional argument. You're not going to find a lot of people that are going to sit there and quote Epicurus or quote, you know, some of these atheistic philosophers. They're going to say, why did my wife die? Why did my child die? That's the kind of person you'll probably have a conversation with who says, I deny God. I cannot believe in a God like that. Well, thank you.